Welcome to the Compliance Perspectives Podcast. I'm Adam Chertoff from the Society of Corporate Compliance and Ethics and Healthcare Compliance Association. Joining me from elsewhere in Los Angeles is Stuart Pardo. Stuart is a professor at Cal State Northridge here, and he'll actually be speaking at the 2019 Compliance and Ethics Institute on the topic of ethical lapses, and that's what we're going to be discussing in the podcast today. Stuart, thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, Adam.
So let's start by asking a pretty fundamental question, but really the one that gets to the heart of it for people is, what drives already and otherwise successful people to commit ethical violations or even engage in criminal conduct?
So much like in medicine, where doctors who I know say they look, with the analogy, they look for the horses, not the zebras. That is to say, they look for the more common explanation as opposed to the more exceptional or unusual one. Much the same, I would say, could be said in the context of business ethics. I mean, there are these outlier situations, say a Bernie Madoff, $65 billion, largest Ponzi scheme in recorded history. More recently, Elizabeth Holmes, the founder and CEO of Theranos, who allegedly had engaged in a massive scheme to not only defraud investors, but to deceive the public with what was allegedly a more efficient and effective way to test blood. So we've tried to look at those instances that are, shall we say, more common, ones that may affect us as individuals. And not to get overly religious, but looking, for example, at Jewish tradition, the Talmud, that when you go to before the heavenly court, what is the first question that one is asked? The first question one is asked, according to that tradition, is, were you honest in business? Not were you a good spouse or a good dad or kind to strangers or contributed to charity, but were you good and honest in business? And for me, that's a very jarring sort of statement. And as I tell my students at the university, you're spending most of your waking hours in business, in the workplace. When you strip away that a third of your life is spent sleeping, another large portion of your life is spent taking care of daily needs. There's really not a lot of time left, and most of that time is going to be spent at work. So you better like what you do, and you better be comfortable in the environment that you're in. The violations that I have seen are things that really could happen to any of us. And that's, for me, what is the most compelling, that there are some basic attributes, and it really could affect any of us.
Yeah, and I think, by the way, using that example of the old Talmudic question is interesting. Also, let it be noted that that's a many thousand-year-old question, which suggests that these issues of people doing wrong in the workplace really go back pretty much as long as there have been people who, you know, working.
Right.
So you mentioned some common attributes. What are the common attributes that you've seen that bad actors have in common?
Well, you know, Adam, I'd say that culture is a big issue. I think cultures matter and matter quite a lot. There's a professor at the Markula School of Applied Business Ethics at Santa Clara, Kirk Hansen, and he very succinctly segments this analysis into three categories. There's an individual level, there's a company level, and there's a societal level. Obviously, it's very difficult for us to control or have any impact at the societal level, but we are impacted by the mores and values of the society, and invariably that affects some of the conduct. There's no question. In terms of the company that we're at, we do have some control over that, and the cultures of those companies do matter and matter a lot. The work of Professor Ariely, who is a behavioral economist in psychology and economics at Duke University, has talked quite extensively about this, and particularly the impact of cheating and the conduct of the people and the culture that you are in and how that impacts your view. And his view ultimately is, at an individual level, we all cheat a little bit. And I think if we're cognizant of that, understanding that there are these outliers who are going to be the excessive cheaters constantly, but for the vast majority of us, we are all cheating a little bit because we want to derive that additional cost, or that rather that additional benefit that we may feel we derive from cheating, without suffering the maybe very extreme consequences that we may ordinarily see from it, but still we have that opportunity to look at ourselves in the mirror and say, you know what, we're still good people who are trying to do the right thing. But my biggest issue is, more than any of that, is whatever codes of ethics that we have, and again, I point to an example like Enron, which, you know, in its code of ethics had language that talked about the necessity to be complying with applicable laws and behaving in an ethical and honorable way, obviously had no impact at all. It was much more about the culture as opposed to what was codified in any particular policy. So when we talk about these common attributes that may exist relative to bad actors, we keep coming back to the culture and to what Professor Hansen outlined in terms of the necessity to have a company that we feel good about in operating within. And if you've got a culture that's sound and strong, I think have a much better chance. In a case like Enron, it was a much more toxic environment. And I think if the people around you, and this ties back to Professor Ariely's research, you see this cheating and it's constant, I think that's going to be a major challenge. In terms of the individual level, I think the attributes are what they are. They are going back to basic challenges of hubris and arrogance and failure to really understand what it is you're doing.
Yeah, and hubris is just a huge issue. One of the questions that often comes up is, you know, how do we prevent this stuff from happening given, you know, the fact that some of this is outside of our control in terms of social stuff and then the individual's hubris. Are there factors that can give us early warning signs of bad behavior?
Yes, I think that there are. I think we start with a very fundamental idea that we have to have some purpose, whatever that purpose is, that company's desire to do something good, to produce a product that we are passionate about or offer a service, to have some basic organizing principle. It's that why, asking the why. Why are we doing this? Why are we here? If we've got some purpose. Now, if the purpose is just to make money, if the purpose is just to advance our own selfish needs, that's not the why I'm talking about. The why I'm talking about is some higher belief or some higher purpose that is bigger than ourselves. That's, I think, what can absolutely lead to the less likelihood of bad things happening. You know, I talked once also to Dennis Kozlowski, who was of course, the CEO of Tyco, and he was in prison, committed to prison for 6 years at a New York State prison for, unauthorized bonuses. And I think that that's, you know, for others to decide. But one of the things that he noted was that they were moving incredibly fast. And when you're moving at a pace where you don't have time to really consider the consequences, to really reflect on the decisions being made, I think that is absolutely a major warning sign. You want to have a chance to reflect on decisions being made and a chance to really think through strategies of things. Because when you're moving at a very pace, inevitably you're going to miss things and you may get caught up in the situation. There's another, I think, issue related to that is just plain sloth. The fact of not being able to pay full attention to what you're supposed to be doing, getting sloppy, if you will. It's that sort of thing. It's ordinarily not thought of as something that is going to be inherently evil or wrong. But in fact, it's that sloppiness, that moving too fast that can really get people in trouble. And that sort of behavior then becomes normalized and regularized. And that's where it can be a real challenge.
Now, given these challenges, what are some of the controls that can be put in place to help prevent them beyond, of course, you know, the traditional ones and compliance programs? I would imagine one of the things is watch out for when you're moving quickly, but I imagine there's others more substantive than that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, look, I'm an attorney, a practicing attorney. I've been doing this for 26 years. I've written my share of company policies, codes of ethics, privacy policies, and the like. And those are certainly important, and they have a place, a very important place. But I think it's important to also think in terms of the poetry or the music of ethics, if you will, not just what's in some sort of soulless policy that is among the stack of documents that are electronically agreed to upon the onboarding of an employee or the annual reaffirmations. Those are, again, important and necessary from a legal perspective. But much like the earlier reference to the Enron Code of Ethics, if you're not living it, if you're not breathing it, there's very little value to it. In fact, I would argue there is an even greater danger around it. So the question then is, okay, how do you translate that poetry and that music into something that's real? And again, that's not easy. But I would say one element is, of course, constant training and good training, not just a sort of going over what the existing policies are, but providing the rationales and the reasons behind it. The other is really understanding what it is that can go wrong and what happens when things go wrong. You know, I think back to when we were growing up and there was this major push to reduce people smoking cigarettes. And I still have these images that are seared in my consciousness about charred lungs and all the rest of tobacco, resulting from tobacco use. Now, I don't know if that's moved the needle or not ultimately, but there's no question that there was a period of time where it did. And I kind of think much like that, if we could spend more time in our training programs to have real life examples of people who suffered, who've gone through these issues themselves, who've paid significant prices and who've suffered consequences, I think that would be very powerful. And on that, Adam, I'm reminded of several encounters I had with a gentleman by the name of Scott London. Scott London, who you may know, was the former head of KPMG's audit group for the Western United States. He was earning over $1 million a year, had tremendous influence in his profession, was respected, but had several lapses and failures of judgment, shared information that was publicly or private information that was then used to trade on publicly traded stocks, and of course was nailed for insider trading. When I met with him, he did show tremendous remorse for his decision, but I would say even beyond the remorse, showed incredible sadness, or conveyed his several sadness. And the one comment he made that very much stuck out and remains with me is, you know, Stuart, had I really thought about the impact that my decisions were having or would have had on my family, not on me, but on my family as a wife, two children, if I had known or really thought about the impact it would have on them, I would have never done it. Had I thought about that, and much like what we call the front page test in the business ethics world in academe is, you know, how would you think or how would you feel if you saw this activity on the front page of the Wall Street Journal? What would grandma think? What would someone in your life who you really love and care about and want and think very highly of, what would they think if they saw that? If we thought more about that before we make certain decisions, when things are moving at a very rapid pace, I think we would be in a much better place.
You know, as you're saying that, you remind me of Jackie Robinson's great line, which is actually the epitaph on his tombstone, which says, "Life is not important except for the impact it has on other lives." Well, Stuart, thank you for sharing those insights with us. I want to thank all of you for taking the time to listen today. I'm Adam Turteltaub from SCCE and HCCA saying, I hope we were able to expand your compliance perspective.